Just a couple of things that I omitted this morning, as I tend to do.
Just a small sort of technicality. We will be doing walking meditation. That will be the break between two periods, apart from this one. And consider the walking meditation to merely be an extension of the sitting meditation. All we do is change our posture. So we are still, as it were, formally meditating. So when we leave and when we come back, we don't need to salute the shrine as we would at the beginning and the end of a session. Just consider it to be a mere change of posture, rather than a letting go of the meditation and then sauntering around for 20 minutes and then coming back and picking it up again. It's very important, actually. It's a very important principle that we will be developing. The importance of seeing this practice as not being fixed to one posture, but having an equal commitment to all of the postures in all situations throughout of our life. So take that as being very symbolic of the spirit of this practice, a seamless practice that doesn't put values on any particular situation and on any particular posture. And the other thing that I omitted is that I do know that some people may have health problems, health difficulties, and the sitting and the structure of the retreat may at times be a little bit difficult. So if those people, it's fine if you want to miss a period. If you feel you can't sit, by all means take a period off, or whatever time you need to take. All I ask is that you don't, when you come back in the middle of a period, walking on the middle of a period. And what's even more important than that, really I believe to be so disruptive, is to actually leave in the middle of a period, because there could be those around you that are really finding things a little bit difficult at that moment, and the last thing that anybody needs is for the person next to them to just get up and walk out. It's the very thing that they themselves would like to do, but are hanging on. So please don't leave in the middle of a period. That's really important. And also don't come back, don't come in while the period is on. The schedule's on the wall, so there's no excuse for that. Well, we'll start off, as it were, or rather we move to the next bit, and just briefly run over the meditation. What would be good is if we could unify our meditation, how we meditate. At least give it a go. This is all about spirit. This isn't about achieving, as you will discover. This is about commitment and doing your best. And the meditation, some of you may well already be engaged in this type of so-called pure awareness, this emptiness practice that is having its time in the movement. And most people here have got some connection with the FWBO, so they're familiar with that. And the great wonder of this meditation is that it's so simple. It's ridiculous, really. And I know when I was actually introduced to it 30 years ago, it took my teacher about a minute to explain it to me, and I've never taken any instruction from that day to this. So if you imagine that this meditation stuff is some amazingly complicated exercise, that it's going to take you months and years to get the understanding of, I don't think that's really true. Actually, I think it's fundamentally so simple. And this type of practice is simple because there are no concepts, there are no systems to learn. And it's basically just to learn to be with yourself. And the way that we start that off, always give attention to your posture. It's something that can so often just be neglected, be thought of as not important. Posture is so important. Not only is it important for the obvious, well, to me what is obvious, that if you are going to commit yourself possibly to meditating every day into the future, possibly for the rest of your life, and we're sitting and we're crossing our legs and we're getting all sorts of gymnastics that we get up to when we meditate. If we don't get it right, we can physically damage ourselves. I mean, that, to me, that's fairly obvious. If we're going to try and sit still for, you know, a good amount of time per day, it's important that we do give our body attention. And the other feature with that is, if our body is out of balance and it's just, you know, twisted up in some way, this has got to have an effect on our mind. Body and mind are not separate, and if our body isn't in balance, we can't expect our mind to be in balance as well. So always give your posture a few moments reflection. This is the advantage of coming early and sitting and getting down and settling yourself. Take a few deep breaths, draw yourself up, and just check your posture. Very simply, without dwelling too long, is that fundamentally we create a three-point contact. It doesn't matter whether we're sitting, kneeling, or sitting on a chair. There's fundamentally a three-point contact with our knees, or with our feet, if we're sitting on the chair, and with our backside. And it's just a very simple principle. The body is just, imagine it to be a tripod. and it's to put the camera, or to put the form, put the body in the mind, the body in the head, in the middle of that tripod. That's all. And the way that we can do that is that we create a hollow in the base of our back. This idea of a straight back is not right. We need to create a hollow, which is a natural hollow. It's not forced. Actually, we're discovering what we've actually got, because the spine is curved. The spine isn't like this. And the way that we can create that natural curve, or rediscover the natural curve, is just to simply to go forward and take our shoulders back. Not let the shoulders do this, but bring them back and then come back up. And if we keep our shoulders back, we will naturally create that down here. And then the heaviest part of our body is our head. So we must get that right, because if that's not in balance, then it's going to rock, it's going to fall over. It's very heavy, is the head. is to pull the chin in. Like this. So you've got the shoulders back and the chin in. And the hollow in the back will put you in the middle of that three-point contact. And that, like a tripod, with a camera on the top, as you may have discovered, is very, very difficult to knock over. You can give it a real thump and it will not fall over. And that's what we aspire to in our posture. So that when the practice does deepen and as most of us have no doubt discovered, we can forget that we got a body. We've lost all awareness of our body and our minds, everything. It will stay there on its own. It doesn't need any attention from us. It will be there. And on those very, very rare occasions, which one or two of you may have discovered over the years, when we fall asleep, you won't actually fall over. You will go slightly over, but you won't actually collapse onto the floor. So you can actually fall asleep and fool everybody that you're meditating. And nobody will ever know. Really, really important to give that attention and bring that into what we do when we sit down. As far as this form of meditation goes, we settle, check the posture, make sure everything is fine. Take a few deep breaths. Deep breaths are always very, very skillful, useful. It's a useful tool to settle ourselves down in all situations. And then just come to our awareness, come to our attention. That will help us with settling down. We'll be able to to return to our awareness. And this is the ideal way that this practice unfolds. It may not work this way, but we simply abide with our awareness. We bring our attention back into our body, and then we bring our attention to our awareness, and we discover that our awareness actually is in the body. That's one of the big discoveries, is that awareness is actually beyond the thinking mind, and actually is actually, if it has a centre, which is something that we can question, if it does have a centre, it will be in our body. And that awareness there, we can just simply settle into that awareness. And if the awareness has a clarity, when thoughts and distractions come, we can notice these distractions and just simply let them go, so that we just abide in that pure awareness, in that unsullied awareness. That's the idea, and that's something that will become more and more possible the more that we pursue this type of practice. Of course, the mind is going to be coming and taking us off, but if we can catch the mind and become aware of the mind and let the mind go, that will, by definition, bring us back into that balance, will bring us back into the body. And then with that commitment, and with that, the virya, the commitment, the energy, the virya, that is a part of our commitment, will allow us to abide just in that awareness and to stay in that awareness. Now, when we arrive at that awareness and we feel that it's pretty okay, it's pretty firmed up. It's not perfect in the sense that things do come and impinge and take us, but we come back because we have that commitment to our awareness. When we arrive in that awareness, we then really come probably to the most important principle of this type of practice, is that that's it. It isn't, oh, okay, now I'm still. Now what? Now what do I do? There is no doing. There is no doing. That's it. And it's to learn to abide and to just be that with that awareness. And with that awareness, it's like a polishing process. When the awareness, which is actually polishing it itself, we become aware maybe of our physical form, we become aware of our motions and our feelings and just how things are, our well-being at this time. It can then also begin in this particular environment, situation, we become aware of people in the room, and now it's raining, we can hear the rain outside. We can become aware of the rain. Maybe there's some birds singing somewhere. We can become aware of the birds. In other words, we just simply become alive. We become alive to our environment. And in that aliveness, we just stay alive. We just stay with that. We don't start picking over it. We don't start the opinion, oh, it's raining. Why is it raining? Oh, I'd like to go for a walk. I can't rain. It's raining hard. It's cold. It's this, it's that. All of these things, we're not interested in any of those labels, any of those designations that we quite naturally and quite normally do and create all the concepts that we do around our experiences. And it's those concepts that create the world and create our attachment and our likes and dislikes, etc. We are beginning to let go of that world that we actually create and just to come back to be with whatever is in front of us, as it were, so to speak, with our environment, what we are in. Now that is, if we can abide there and stay there, as I say, there is nowhere else to go. And then we see how the world reacts to that environment that we create. And out of that reaction, from that, just that pure awareness, comes the world and all that goes to make up the world, And it's from there that we actually begin to start to understand ourselves. But the basic principle is always return to that sense of just being, of being. That's all. To come back to that sense of being. This is what we aspire to. Now the reality is, I have to be pragmatic about this. This is ideal. Is that most of us, a lot of the time, maybe all of the time for some people, find that not possible because the mind is so restless and we're so agitated that we need something stronger. This is very subtle, actually very gentle. And so what we can do as an expedient means, as a skillful tool, is to employ, as I'm sure all of us are, we've all got some knowledge of I think the best is Anapanasati's mindfulness of breathing, because it's fundamentally a non-conceptual practice. It harmonizes with the spirit of this openness. It isn't about developing concepts. It is to pick, no doubt most of you know stages of this, to pick one stage. We don't need all the stages because that's not the spirit. We just need one that we can put our attention on and cultivate. Preferably a stage that actually takes place in the body, ideally, not essentially. And just stay with that particular familiarity of mindfulness of breathing, to stay with that until we really begin to settle us, until we really begin to feel as though we're settling. This is a means to an end. This is not an end in itself. It's an expedient means that we may employ for 5 seconds, maybe 5 minutes, maybe for the rest of the day. Because actually it doesn't matter, because we're not going anywhere. We're not trying to, you know, by 9 o'clock tonight, I've got to get there, I've got to get over there somewhere. And I'm going on this journey, and I've got to achieve, and I've got to take these steps so that come this evening or come next Friday, I am over there. If we get into that frame of mind, we're missing something very, very important. Because fundamentally, we're already there. There actually isn't anywhere to go, because we're already there. And all we need to do is to wake up to where we actually really are. We don't create it. It's not something that we manufacture. It's that we merely wake up to what we really are. And that what we really are isn't a lateral journey, as we may imagine, that I am here and I've got to do this, this and this and this, and then eventually I'm going to get there, over there somewhere. That's actually, it's a misunderstanding. And it's a very good thing to try and wean ourselves off of that thing that I am here and I've got to get over there, especially with this practice, this sort of practice, this notion that I am here, I've got to develop this in order to become, get over that, or to become that. I am this and I want to become that. This is such a massive, massive conditioning that we've all got. And it's that conditioning that we are beginning to send into change. And that basic principle of waking up to where we really are, this journey of no journey, that principle is put in place immediately we start to meditate, is that we are just aspiring to be our true nature, which is that clear, unsullied awareness that is beyond the chattering mind, the emotions and the whole world that we create. We are the creator. Nobody gives us this world. We make it from when we're a baby. We manufacture it completely, lock, stock and barrel. No compromise. We begin to just allow that to fall off. Now, if as I say, if we can't put this into effect immediately, and it's not that easy, it has to be said, because you know, I'm sure we all are aware how we are caught up with our chattering mind and how the power that it's got, and the way it gets its way so often. So we employ the skillful means, preferably one of the breathing techniques, simply because it's non-conceptual. And actually, Anapanasati, which is often regarded as something that we do along the way, actually is a deeply profound practice, because that actually, when it perfects, when it is really refined, becomes pure awareness itself. And it's not, it actually is pure awareness in its, if you like, in its infancy. It is the meditation of the Buddhas. It is the only meditation that Buddhas actually take doctrinally. So never underestimate Anapanasati. It is deeply profound. But we use just a little bit of it just to settle ourselves down. Like I say, a few seconds. We don't set off, I'm going to do this for X amount of time or whatever. We use it until we need, and then we can let it go, whether it's a few seconds, a few minutes. And if we can't settle, then the rest of the day, no problem. No problem, absolutely no problem. But always aspire. I'm not going to be doing this all the time. I'm going to let this go as soon as conditions allow me to let it go. So when you feel, and it's your decision, when you feel pretty much settled, and don't look for perfection, because you're never going to get it. When you feel pretty settled, then let it go. And then just come back and abide in that awareness. And when you wander, just with the brightness that you're cultivating, you will be able to let go of those thoughts and those distractions and just come back. And when you feel nice and gathered and feel still, don't fall into the trap of, okay, what's next? That's the big one. But learn to abide in that awareness. And what will happen? It happens in all meditation, is that when we become still, then the restlessness and the emotional relationship we have with the world, with ourselves and with others, starts to bubble up, starts to kick in and say, I'm sorry, Dave, but you're not going to do that. And then things begin to come up, our karmic things begin to come up, and we find that actually that this, what appears to be a very misunderstood as something passive, so passive that there's nothing to do, it's such a passive thing that it's pretty worthless, and all you're going to do is fall asleep. Actually, the commitment we have to stay in that awareness actually has to be very much in place, because that world that is determined to take us away from that stillness will come with great force and start to pull us this way and pull us that way and pull us back into our habits and into our relationship, fundamentally our relationship with ourselves, and begin that whole challenge that comes out of that. And it's then that we learn how to work with those forces, how to open ourselves to those forces and not to be carried away by them. And that apparent sort of passiveness, as can often be misunderstood with this practice, becomes so dynamic and will require every ounce of commitment in you to do nothing. So I'd like you to give this a go. I know there's probably many different sorts of meditations that get used in this room by many people. It's an abundant realm. So many different techniques and so many ways of going about different things. This is conceptualist. There's no formula here. It's just learning to be in your natural state. Give it a go. see how it goes. Keep bringing yourself back to it. Try not to be disheartened. bring that commitment and bring that energy. Bring that willingness to come back. And we see how it goes. See if it, and it'd be interesting to hear people's experiences with that. And that fundamentally is about as much as I want to say about meditation. Because to be quite honest with you, I find the whole subject of meditation and stuff pretty boring, actually. Don't tell anybody, do you? You know, throughout my early years of practice, I can honestly say my teacher, who spoke a lot and used to like talking even more than I do, actually, thinking about it, I don't think the subject of meditation ever came up in all of those years. Interesting, isn't it? And yet so many of us seem to think that Dharma practice is all about this thing, sitting on the floor and developing meditation and cultivating all these mysterious practices that go back to the Buddha. In fact, most of them were invented by the Buddha. And going along that very mysterious path where we're sitting and sitting and sitting and thinking that Dharma practice, this is Dharma practice. It is about perfecting different forms of meditation, sitting down and sitting for hours. And I think that's actually, I don't think that's the case actually. Sitting meditation, of course, is very important, and we could say that it's the most important aspect of practice, simply because it allows us to gather ourselves up to a degree that we cannot possibly do in our daily life. We create this environment where we shut the world down and all distractions, so that we can really gather ourselves up, focus, look in and cultivate whatever practice it may be. And it's essential. There's no option with this. But the mistake that can be made quite easily is that this is the be all and the end all. This is what it's all about, and I think that's a very big mistake. I think this, yes, it will have its fruit. It will have its change can take place by focusing exclusively on sitting, as I know a lot of people do, and I've known lots of people in the past that do not. This is their practice. And of course it's going to work, it's going to change, but I don't think it will fulfill the complete fruit that the Buddha promised us, that the practice actually promises us. I think it's great and it's profound and it's life changing, but it is not the complete fruit of what practice can offer. And I believe it's that complete fruit that actually takes us to the breakthrough, to our original nature, to stream entry, whatever you want to call it. In order for that, for that to be fulfilled, there has to be a much broader base put in place. We cannot just narrow it down to sitting on our backsides. We need to bring the whole of our life, from the moment we wake to the moment we go to sleep. And in fact, the time may come when we can actually incorporate our sleep into our practice, but never mind that, that's not so important. That we need to learn to open up to the whole of our experience of life. to give every experience and every moment experience in all the four postures. You know, in Buddhism we have four postures of sitting, standing, walking and lying down. These are the four postures that we use, one of those four postures we use while we're still alive. And I suppose when we're dead, we still use one of the postures thinking about it. And it certainly applies to this type of practice that doesn't put all its eggs in one basket, the meditation basket. That we learn to bring that practice, learn that spirit that I was just talking about, the spirit of gathering ourselves up and just being. just being in the moment, as we like to say, just being in the situation that the great mystery presents to us right now, in order to fulfill that aspiration, we really need to take this practice into all of our postures. Not this sort of, you know, to have a graph where we aspire to our meditation and we're really concentrated and we're fulfilling all the things that we're supposed to be fulfilling, and then we let go of our meditation when the bell goes, and then we come back down here again, and then we meander along, and then we sit again, and then we go like this again, and then when that's finished, we come back down. So we have a graph like this. That will bring its fruit, but it will never ever fulfill its full potential. What we aspire to will be taken on the whole of practice, rather than do this up and down like that. We aspire to have a graph that runs like this, and that is called the middle way. And it's when that middle way is perfected, when we can get that graph to run like this, this is when your true nature will reveal itself. That middle way is not negotiable. It isn't something on your terms. It's something that we have to go to, that we have to aspire to, in order to truly bring that equanimity to the whole of our being, to the whole of our life. And therefore it is essential that we begin to realise and begin to take on the whole of our life as being a part of our practice. Not just in an ethical sense, because ethics will embrace a lot of our life about becoming a good person and not being a bad person anymore, and all that, and all the sort of nuances within that. That's actually a very useful tool, but that's not the true equanimity, because that's not being like this sort of person anymore, that's becoming another sort of a person. Well, that too is not the true equanimity. It helps, it's a tool, but it's not the true aspiration of ethical behaviour. Ethics are an upaya, a means to an end, and to go beyond that desire to be a good person. Because that too is still existing in the dualistic world. So the importance of bringing that mentality, that spirit, and to get away from this idea that it's all about sitting on the cushion is a very important feature to actually begin to grow into, to see that every aspect of our life is equally important as the sitting meditation, so we can bring that spirit of just being aware in all circumstances, bring that to fruition. I think that's the basic framework, and I think you'll find that I'm sure as we talk and communicate over these days, that we'll actually be bringing aspects of how we find life. How we find life so difficult to actually engage with that spirit, and how we're actually pulled around, and how we are blinded, and how we just get so very easily lost in our practice. We find that most of this actually will be talking about the other postures, not very little about the meditation posture. And I think this is actually a very good way of approaching the practice. Is that okay? Does anybody violently object? Has anybody got any queries on that? Is it maybe just a... I know quite a number of you know me, but I also know there's older people that don't know me. And I, like I say, I do put the emphasis much more on on our normal everyday practice. So it may, as I say, it may be a new feature for some people, but so you know, something to grow into here. So does anybody have a query on that at all?
You mentioned polishing one's sense of awareness and then one's sitting. Do you use the same techniques in other postures that you would polish awareness on the cushion as off?
Well, this is one of the limitations of language, or at least my language anyway, I have to say, is that there isn't anybody who does the polishing, you see. If there was something that you do in order to polish, then that would be a technique. That would be a doing something. It's awareness polishing itself. It's clarifying itself. When your awareness is in place, undistracted, it will naturally become brighter and brighter. It will see brighter, and the distractions that come, it will catch and let go of the distraction. So there isn't actually a technique. You can't say that there's a technique. There isn't anything that you bring along. The only way that we'll compromise with that is when we're on the cushion, when we start meditating. That is a compromise. That's not really what we're after, but it helps. But to learn, you know, is familiarity. Familiarity is a very, very important concept in Buddhism. We're always going into the unknown. So when we have new experiences, it's to become familiar, that familiarity which helps us to grow into that even more and actually go beyond resistance and fears and things. Familiarity is so important. And to begin to get that familiarity when we're on the cushion, I'm just letting go. Mm. Just that you're on the cushion, you know, all you're going to do is just sit there with brightness. Not with dullness, but with brightness. Because awareness is so bright, it's infinite. It has no impediments in itself. So when those distractions come along, we just learn to let them go and just be as we are in that particular environment. And then we can take that out. We can take it into the dining room, for example. When we go in there, we can have all sorts of mental, you know, that our relationship with food is very strong most of the time. And there's a whole world that can kick in, that can come, one of desire and one of aversion. All sorts of scenarios can come up just through that experience of going in the dining room and collecting our food, sitting down and eating it. But with awareness, when we have awareness, we can catch ourselves and just let those old habits go. Those avenues that we go down that are so captivating, that seduce us and that take us away to such an extent that we can actually eat the whole meal and not be aware that we've eaten it. I mean, that's what we're dealing with, and we all experience that. This is what we're beginning to awaken to, beginning to open ourselves to, because eating the meal and being at one with it, being this is what's in front of me, this is what I am now doing, i.e. eating that meal, that is no different than you sitting on your cushion in this environment and just being. What is the difference? Is there a difference? It's infinitely more difficult because we're no longer in this contrived environment. We're out there, there's people, there's all sorts of noises going on and things going on, and we can so easily get caught up with those hot spots, because food is a hot spot for most of us somewhere along the line. Different things. It's one of the things that we can get ourselves involved with quite easily. We get involved with all of that. And, you know, just to become aware that, you know, for goodness sake, I've walked in here and I've just eaten a meal that the poor cook has spent hours thinking about and cooking for us, making us happy and fulfilled. And damn me, I've not even tasted the thing. Because why? Because I'm just caught up with all my habitual reactions to that particular environment, that particular situation. And that there is equally important to work on and to become alive to, is when you're sitting on there and you think, oh well, I've done my meditation now, I've been really still for the last half an hour. Good, that's it, great, I'll let it all go now, and then go off and then just be spaced out for the rest of the day and have no real contact with just the mundane every day. We don't have that contact. This is the graph I'm talking about. And it's a learning to, yeah, okay, we all know about getting up there when we're meditating. Nobody needs to tell us about that. We all know that's where we're going or what we should be doing. But let's talk about the bit that's off that peak, and which actually probably in our normal life would take care of the next 23 of the 24 hours that we're living, actually. Not half an hour, but the rest of our life. We just don't even think about that. It's to bring that principle, it's to bring that aspiration, that commitment into the rest of our lives. And if you can pick what we're actually doing here, you can pick it because it's clearer in this environment. You can pick. You can say, ah, right. You can then take it with you when you get up from the cushion and you go out for the walk in meditation. What's the difference? What's the difference? And then we go and, you know, we're going to go have lunch and then we're going to come to the most difficult time of the retreat, when we're going to have 3 hours. 3 hours of nothing to do. Oh my God. At least when I'm here, I'm sitting and I'm doing something and I'm achieving something. 3 hours. What a waste. What a waste of time. 3 hours of doing nothing. I mean, apart from, of course, the people have to wash up, but we don't have to do these things every day. So we have plenty of time, actually, when we're doing nothing. How difficult. Isn't that the most difficult thing? What are we going to do to entertain ourselves? There's a library there, which I notice is very populated every time I walk through it. I have to push past several people in order to get from one entrance to the other. Just finding ways of filling that space up. Rather than, look, I'm offering you on the retreat, let's say 2 of those 3 hours of doing nothing. You know, I ask you to come in here and meditate. I put this is my invention, this schedule, the whole thing is my creation. I've asked you to meditate, to come in and meditate, and you all do it quite willingly, come in. Now I'm going to ask you to do 2 hours a day to do nothing. Now, are you prepared to do that? Or do you want to create diversions? Do nothing means just to be with yourself. Just to be with what is in front of you. Go for a nice walk. Maybe just sit in your room, look out the window. Just be with yourself. That's what I'm asking. Rather than diverting. And accept that as your meditation. This is like sitting meditation. This is 2 hours of not doing anything meditation. Exactly the same. But there is no difference. So you sit there, or let's say you're walking along the road. Rather than be in that wonderful environment, even if it's raining, it's still a wonderful environment. That wonderful experience, the sensory experience of just walking along the road in the rain and the dampness and the, not to mention the views and just the whole environment and to just feel a part of it is such a joy. And yet, I know from personal experience, maybe you can relate to this, maybe not, I don't know. I am making assumptions here. I could walk down that road, I don't know, a long way, half an hour, turn around and come back, and I could swear blind I never even went on the walk. I've been just so caught up in myself, thinking this and thinking that, that actually I have very, very little engagement with the environment that I'm in. This is what we're aspiring to, because this is at the basic fundamental human dilemma, is that we don't actually live life at all. We live only a part of life. Most of life, actually, we're just caught up with ourselves, and we're not actually with what's in front of us. Because if we truly were with what's in front of us, we would be fulfilled people, individuals. We would be fulfilled human beings. And we would want for nothing. And we would not go seeking here and there to fill up the emptiness that we all experience. We would just be fulfilled because we would be at one with what is our true nature, our home, where we really are. And it's that learning to take that, when we go for a walk, to just bring ourselves back. My feet walking along the ground, on the road, if we're on the road, and just be aware of the environment, of the puddles and the rain and the dying of the plants and the leaves falling off the trees and the lake and the loch and all of these things. Just to bring ourselves back, just to be there. Not, and when we're back there, when we've come back to that direct experience, then don't turn around and say to us, okay, now what? There is no now what, that's it, and learn to stay there. So to see that we can take this practice into all of the postures, into all situations, is what we're aspiring to. So there are no techniques. If you want to call it, if you want to call coming back to yourself, awakening to yourself, okay, I'm practicing the Dharma. Then if you want to call that a technique, then that's a technique, but that's as far as it goes. Yeah. And when you awaken to yourself, don't fall into the trap of now there is something to do, somewhere to go, something to be, something to become. This is not the spirit. And I think that's the ultimate spirit of all Dharma practices. Buddhism is full of skillful means, upayas. They're always, we can't do this. So Buddhism, the Buddha and various other great enlightened beings down the ages have developed techniques, techniques to actually bring us back to what we are. And what we do with this particular practice, and this is what makes it so simple and yet so difficult, is that we, as it were, we leapfrog over all of those upayas, and we don't actually bring any upayas to our practice at all. That's what we're doing. And this is why it's the most difficult form of practice. But it's the most direct way. It's the most misunderstood way, because we are not doing something as other forms of what is called Buddhism. This isn't actually Buddhism, actually. This is leaping over Buddhism, because Buddhism is a set of upayas, a creation created by people to help us aspire to, you know, if you want to call it enlightenment or call it to returning to our true nature. It's an upaya. Buddhism is an upaya. It isn't the Dharma itself. The Dharma is beyond Buddhism. And by learning to come back into, learning to stay with ourselves, is to go beyond Buddhism, and is actually to abide in the truth, is to learn to abide in the Dharma itself. The Dharma is a natural law. The Buddha never invented it. He didn't create it. He just developed techniques that allowed us to aspire to that natural law. And what we're doing with this type of practice is that we're just aspiring to the natural law. We're leaping over everything. This is why it's so misunderstood. It is simplicity itself when you actually see it. It is the absolute. It's so simple, actually, we can't see it. We think that we have to do something. We have to, if this is so profound and this is the truth and wisdom and stuff, we've got to go off on this journey of creating this thing called wisdom.
I think there are characteristics in, you use the word abiding in, that we can deconstruct abiding in, and there are some qualities inherent in that, which are almost like techniques as far as I can see.
Well, I'll say, I'm making this just trying to put the sort of ideal framework in place here. What the reality of what happens, if you like, when we actually engage more. I'm trying to create the spirit so that it embraces everything.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to exclude anything. I'm not trying to say that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Let's not bother with that. This is the important bit. Let's just sort of stick that to one side. It's so important to realise that if you wish to aspire to true completeness, to true humanness, it is necessary to open up to the whole of yourself in all situations. And there is no picking and choosing. There are no different values and grades. And this is all what we create. And we need to learn, and it's a massively deep conditioning that we need to learn to unpick and learn to not fall into that trap. Because we get, by falling into that trap, we are falling into the very thing that in a sense we're trying to go beyond, i.e. the dualistic world. That we are the dualistic world is not a natural thing. It's something that the human mind creates, the human being creates. And when we fall into that dualistic world, however subtle and refined it may seem to be, it is still not the truth. It is duality. And it's a learning that we need to, in order to aspire to letting that duality go, we must not pick and choose. Give things value. Just let everything go. That's the true spirit of it. And if we can put that in place as the underlying spirit and structure and form, get that in place, which means that we have to return to it over and over and over and over and over and over. When we put that truly in place so that it becomes a habit, if you like, this becomes our new conditioning, if you like, then we can learn to play within that structure. And that's when we can start to learn to work with those forces inside of us, our emotional forces that pull us all over the place, that are so powerful. They are so powerful that even when this body has run its course, run its life, could be 100 years, and eventually it falls to pieces, those forces are so powerful they just carry on and they create another form, and on it goes. And when you understand these things, you see that actually it's never had a beginning. And unless we are prepared to aspire to the truth, it will never end. So when that framework it's not an object that we put in place and then it's there. It's something that we can lose very easily. We can lose it, but we can nurture it, and we can really make that become a part of our very being. And when we can learn to become familiar with that, we learn how we can strengthen it up. We can then begin to free ourselves up and begin to work with those forces that are clearly hell-bent on stopping us from actually aspiring to that complete openness. And it's then that we can begin to, through awareness, through that clarity, actually begin to see what makes this world, how this world comes into being, and how we are so bound by it, how we are so enslaved to it. And then begin to, through that awareness and through that commitment, that sense of bondage, that dualistic world that we've all created, can actually begin to go into change. It's like it starts to unpick itself. It's like peeling an onion. Bits begin to go into change. But it's always done, and it's always done within that framework. And in order to begin to open up to ourselves and begin to work with those forces, which are essentially emotional forces. We need to have that framework in place, and when the framework is in place, we can begin to open to those forces and begin to play with those forces, and maybe to begin to investigate and to look into those forces and begin to get to understand and begin to learn to accept them rather than fall into the old habit, the old reactive habit. Learn to accept them in the sense that we learn to open up to those habitual forces. This is not denial, this is not suppression, this is how we are. Things come up, we learn to open up to those forces. But we now, through awareness and through our commitment, we stop ourselves from falling into the old habit of just reinforcing those particular things, but learn to open, to accept and contain those forces. And it's through that spirit of learning to open and learning to contain that we can begin to get to understand and begin to see and begin to understand what on earth is going on. What is it that just seems to have such control over us? But that's only going to be possible through that framework, through that spirit that we're beginning to nurture, that spirit of being with, of opening to with whatever's in front of us. And whatever's in front of us is generally our emotional reactions to whatever the particular scenario may be, whether it's with our friends, our colleagues, whether it's with just walking down the road. Primarily, it's our reactions to ourselves and our relationship with ourselves, is that we begin to become aware of more and more and see that it's very much emotionally charged, and how we keep falling into those habits, that somehow that they are so ingrained that I cannot even sit down and eat a piece of marmalade on toast, that it impinges so much that I'm not even aware of what I'm eating, something so simple. And to learn to, rather than falling into the old reactive way that blinds us, that keeps us blind, that we learn now through awareness, learn to open up and say yes to these old habits, but not to fall back into their grip and reinforce them. But learn to stay, and this now we come into a crucial feature, learn to stay with the immense emotional drive that gives all of these things in us life. This emotional drive that is so powerful, like a wild animal, that when those emotions run, we've just got no control. We just fall into our old habits. And we just become a victim of what we've been doing, our habits that we've been stuck with, possibly all of our lives. And that's the emotional drive. Actually, it's the emotion that actually perpetuates the habit much more than the thought, because it's the emotion that gives the thoughts life. Thoughts in themselves, if we really look at thoughts, are just, what are they? They're just empty something or other that just rise and pass away. They're just like looking through a window. It's like they're transparent, actually. When our emotions get involved with those thoughts, suddenly they become alive, they become real, they become solid, they become absolutely, absolutely real. So then we arrive at this very important realization, actually. Well, maybe the skillful way of dealing with this inability that I have of actually just being with what's in front of me, maybe I should look at the emotional involvement much more than the picture and the thought. And to discover that emotion is to be found in the body. And this is a very, very crucial feature of Dharma practice. Emotion is in the body, it is in the physical. It's in the body, not only is it in the body, but it's actually in the lower part of the body. This is not something of the head. The thoughts and the pictures are up here, but that which gives it life, what in their true nature, are just transparent things that rise and pass away, if we allow them to. The real important aspect of that experience is the emotion that gives those thoughts life, and to see that those emotions are in the body, and that actually, in truth, we need to be working with the emotion, to transform, or allow the emotion to transform, and to see two crucial features. One, that awareness mysteriously actually isn't in the head at all. You will discover through stillness and through being with yourself that actually awareness is in the body. Awareness is in the body and the emotion is in the body. And to see that is very much at the heart of what Dharma practice is about. Those two crucial feet. There is no practice without awareness. Awareness is the key, is the jewel in the crown. Is that part of us that allows, this is where self-awareness comes from and where change can come from. It's in that awareness. We have awareness, unlike most animals, for example, that don't have awareness, and they're just victims all of their lives of their instincts. And they have no choice with whatever they do. They just follow their instincts. We're different. We do have a choice. It may not seem like it a lot of the time, but we do have choice. And that awareness, which is the jewel in the crown, is in the body. And our emotions are in the body. So therefore, it becomes obvious that if we truly wish to enter the transforming process, that Dharma, genuine transformation, that the Dharma promises us, we must learn to come into our body and learn to practice in our body and learn to be in our body and learn to stay in our body. Now that is, for a lot of people, quite a revolutionary understanding, because so many of us have got this idea that this practice is all about working it out in the head. And that is, I believe, to be a very, very big mistake. It's very much a learning to awaken to the body first of all. There's so many of us, so many people, I've met people, don't even know they've got a body. They're so locked in their head. They don't even know they have a body. Just in their heads 24 hours a day. So even to acknowledge that you have a body is actually quite a big leap. So to acknowledge that we have a body and that awareness is in the body and the emotions are in the body, and actually the more that we stay there, the more that we become alive to the body, we will actually discover that actually this is where samsara is also, is in the body. It's not something of the head. It's actually based, it's ground. It lives, it's nurtured, it is encouraged in the body, right in the seat of the emotions, right with the emotions, right in the lower part of our body. And as all good Buddhists know, we've all read that samsara and nirvana are not two. We all know that, don't we? They're not two separate things, as it were. Where you find samsara, you will find nirvana, because the two aren't two at all. So even more discovery that the body not only contains awareness, not only contains emotion, it not only contains samsara, it also contains awakening, the gate to awakening. It's actually also in the body. So why is it that we spend all of our lives in our heads? Is it any wonder that we have to drag ourselves up here into Scotland to actually try to get to the bottom, get to understand why we are so bound up with ourselves in this samsaric world that just literally does not have an ending? It's because we're in the wrong place. We need to go to where the action is, actually. We need to go there and we need to learn to open up to that area and to take the practice actually into the body. And it's from that place there that change can begin to take place. So when we walk down the road, we are aware that we're walking down the road. There is actually a form walking along, and there are legs sticking out one in front of the other as we walk along. Be aware of that. When you are, you're in your body. When you're aware, you're in your body. When you're aware, you're not in your head. When you're thinking, you're in your head. And then get blinded by those thoughts. Come into the body and learn to stay in the body. Take the practice, take the whole of your life into the body. When you're on the cushion, take the practice to your body. Learn to open up to what is a most remarkable revolution in your own personal development. Or maybe for years you've been taught that the answers you're looking for are going to be found out by working it out in your head. Well, whatever can be worked out in the head is actually very, very superficial to the full potential that we all have. So to learn to bring the practice into the body is a tremendously revolutionary step in our path to awakening. And to want to just to come back and to abide in the body, okay, we may agree with that. We will find that even when we've made that discovery, that I want to actually come back into the body and live my life out of my body rather than out of my head. Find how incredibly difficult it actually is. How we are continually pulled back up into the mind, into that blinding dualistic world that we've created. It's so blinding that we've lost the moment. We've lost what's in front of us. And this manipulating fellow that arrives on the scene, that tries to manipulate that experience, tries to manipulate that world, and tries to possess that world. Anything will do, as long as we're not actually in the moment, actually with what is in front of us. Just to be open and accept what's in front of us. It's that we need to then begin to open up to and awaken to and learn to work with those emotional forces within this. This is so crucial. It's within that framework, that we're always returning to, that we're always nurturing. This isn't something you put in place and it's there. It will go if we're not careful. We have to come back all the time. Come back into the body. And that begins to develop that framework. So when those emotions then begin to rise up within the body, we can learn to bear with them and not become their victim anymore, and learn to open up to that transforming process. And that opening up, you know, this may sound like some sort of an exercise, something that you know you're going to sort of understand and put into effect, possibly, hopefully, but actually what we're actually learning to do, and it's nothing more than this. It truly, truly is nothing more than this. And Buddhism can be incredibly complicated and incredibly intricate that we can spend our life studying it and working it all out. But what we're truly doing, when we're truly on the path of transformation, is that we're doing nothing more than making friends with ourselves. That's all it is, you know. We're making friends with ourselves. But we're making friends with ourselves in a dharmic way. Not in a worldly way, but in a dharmic way. And the dharmic way is like I was saying about putting the mirror up yesterday when I was talking about silence, putting the mirror up, is to open up to ourselves and to see ourselves, but not to buy into that reactivity, not to buy into that dualistic reaction that we have with our experiences, but learning to say, yes, this is the way I am. Open up to that, not say, this is the way I am, and then go and carry on as you were before. That's the misunderstanding of accepting. It is not passive like that. It isn't about buying into your old habits. It's learning to open up and to accept your old habits. your old fears and your old desires and aversions, that whole world that will come to us when we learn to open up and learn to give it space. The accepting is to embrace that old world and say, yes, this is the way I am. This is the way I am. But we don't say, you're good, you're bad, you're right, you're wrong. We don't engage with it. We don't, as we often do, as us Westerns like to do far more than most people, we like to get into that disparaging state of mind where we so easily can beat ourselves up, put ourselves down. Oh, I'm no good, I'm this and that. I'm no good, I'm rubbish, I can't do this practice, I'm not a nice person, I do this and I do that. Is to learn not to fall back into that old habit, because that is the very thing that reinforces this world, this dualism that we are stuck in. Is to learn to just accept this is the way I am, and to embrace that whole world that will evoke, emotional world that will evoke. Say yes, embrace, say yes. You will find that will have such an emotional impact, and that emotional impact will be here, it will be in your body. So the practice is in your body. You will learn to contain that emotional, like a wild animal that wants to rush. You learn to tether it and learn to keep it in. You're not suppressing it. You're not saying, go away, you horrible thing. I'm going to push you and bury you and I don't like you. That's what we used to do in the past. Now we say yes. And we open up to that. And we learn to carry that around in our daily lives and learn to stay with that. This is physical. This is emotional. This is physical, and it's in that opening and learning to accept ourselves in the true dharmic sense of accepting ourselves. It's in that accepting that this quite remarkable characteristic of dharma change, of true dharmic change. That we assume that we change because we have to do something in order to make ourselves change. The true change and the dharmic change, which is different to the worldly change that we are familiar with, is to do nothing. Is to accept and to open. And what we're really doing there, what we're really doing, is that we're beginning a journey of making friends with ourselves. And when we truly make friends with ourselves, then this whole dharmic world will begin to go into change, will begin to fall off, and will begin to transform, so that little by little we begin to return to our true being, our true nature, our true humanness. To Buddha nature, to the Buddha, I don't know, there's probably 50 different ways of describing, in Buddhism, never mind, in other religions. We are beginning that journey of reintegrating, of becoming one with our true nature. And what are we doing? We're doing nothing. And this is what's so deeply, deeply profound. Because we are utterly, utterly convinced that there is something that we must do. And we spend our whole lives trying to find out what that secret is. And we never find it, because we can't actually discover or accept the utter simplicity of actually returning to our true nature and of truly beginning and fulfilling that relationship with ourselves, that friendliness that actually turns to love, genuine love, not the dualistic love that most of us experience, but that love for ourselves, because we see that actually our true selves, when all this nonsense goes into change, is eternal and embraces all of life. This is the true love. This is the true friendship. And we have to do nothing in order to aspire to it. So that will do for today. Thank you.